Hello, it's about that time. So just a reminder to everyone that the presentations that you see today will be on the ICMC website. And there's information for accessing those in your program on page 3, if I'm not mistaken. So up next, Lachlan Turner from Lightship. Warm up.
You haven't heard what I have to say yet, so hold your applause, man. I'm starting my timer here. So yeah, I was formerly Arc InfoSec. Arc InfoSec has now joined forces with Lightship Security. So, and this conference is our coming out party. So, got the new T-shirt. Happy about that. Happy to be partnered with the guys. And yeah, we're going to talk about protection profiles because there was a lot of content about CPPs in the conference, and I thought, hey guys, maybe we should talk a little bit about what a protection profile is, because there's probably going to be people here that maybe aren't too familiar. So I'll talk a little bit about protection profiles and then also how to comply with them. So to understand protection profiles, you kind of got to know a little bit about common criteria. So we'll do a little 101 on common criteria. Not too much, just enough to give you a little taste so that you can understand what a protection profile is. So then we'll go into what is a protection profile, what's a collaborative protection profile, what does that mean, and then how you might go about complying with one of these. So, common criteria. What do we got? So who are the players when it comes to common criteria? Well, we have a vendor, you guys, you know, with a product to evaluate. You have a lab that has been accredited by a national scheme. So for example, the Canadian scheme or the US scheme, and that's international. And then we have the consumer that at the end of the day purchases the vendor's products. And generally the consumer is purchasing because they have to due to a policy, usually a policy driver that requires them to purchase assured products. So they're the kind of players in the whole process. And then we have you might, when you're around common criteria and protection profiles, you might hear about a TOE. You're like, what's a TOE? That's the target of evaluation, which is the thing that we're looking at. And the thing that we're looking at is typically not the whole product. Usually it's a fraction, a subset of the security functionality. And that is described in what is called the security target. And the security target is just a document that describes what the evaluation is going to be looking at. So that sets the scope, sets the scene for the whole evaluation piece. So, and that can be, that's in terms of physically, you know, what does the consumer purchase, and then also which parts of the product are actually being investigated. And so all of that information is included in the security target document. So let's dig into this security target document a little bit to find out about it. And remember that it is the document that defines the TOE. We have an introduction. And that's some fairly high-level information to, in kind of plain English narrative, introduce what the product is and what the scope of the evaluation in broad terms is. Then we have some CC specific conformance claims, which, you know, call out things like what version of the common criteria we're complying with, which protection profile we're complying with, perhaps which technical decisions from NIAP, if it's undergoing through NIAP or a NIAP or a scheme that, or if the product is going to end up on the NIAP PCL, you'll want to address some technical decisions if there are any for your protection profile. So we have some of that information there. Then there's a what we call in the Common Criteria a security problem definition, which is really a threat model and then a set of security objectives to address the threats. So that's something you'll see in every security target document. And then linked to those security objectives, we have what are called security functional requirements. And I'll dig into exactly what a security functional requirement is in the next couple of slides here. But essentially, they are the functions that are under evaluation. And then we have what's called security assurance requirements. Security assurance requirements are the actions that the developer and the evaluator perform in order to actually generate this assurance that we're actually on about. And I'll dig into what a security assurance requirement actually looks like and what that really means, because the concepts themselves are a little arcane until you see exactly what we're talking about. And then there's a TOW summary specification, which is a description of how the product actually implements the functions. It's again, if you're just looking at a security target for the first time and you're like, what does all of this mean? Flip to the back, flip to section 6, TOW summary specification, and you'll be like, oh, I can read this part. So you can skip all the rest and just focus on the TOW summary spec if you really want to make sense. That and the introduction. So security functional requirement, what is it? Or what are they? Well, the Common Criteria, Part 2, has a whole catalog of security functional requirements. And these are semi-formal statements of functionality. So, for example, here's one with regards to authentication. So we see here FIA UAU.fi. This is just an identifier, a unique identifier for the requirement. The TSF. TSF is just TOW security functions, the TOW, the thing under evaluation. Shall provide, and then there's a space for the vendor to complete or the consultant, multiple authentication mechanisms, password, finger scan, whatever you want to put in there to support user authentication. So that's one example of a functional requirement. A single statement that addresses a single piece of functionality. And your security target will be made up of multiple functional requirement claims. And these are drawn from CC Part 2. Or, because Common Criteria is extensible, that you may create your own or extend the existing ones. And we see that a lot in protection profiles these days. So some more concrete examples. Here we have our trusty smartphone. And I actually took a look at, I think it was Apple's security target, and just had a look at some of the functional claims that they make. And so these are what we would call classes of functional requirements, but to give you a flavor, a sense, an idea. So, on your smartphone, you have some cryptographic support. So you'll have a bunch of functional requirements, individual statements of requirement around crypto. User data protection. What do we do in terms of encrypting data at rest and those sorts of things? Identification and authentication. Security management, so that's things like the roles that the security roles or administrator roles that might be present on the device, what management functionality might be present. All of that gets enumerated in these security functional requirements. Protection of the TSF, so that's self-protection, self-testing, integrity, those sorts of things. TOW access, which is things like an access banner. When you log in, you need to display a banner. And trusted path, trusted channel, so that's when we're a remote administrator is logging in, you might have a trusted path for that. That can get described as a security functional requirement. So as a vendor, let's say Mr. Apple comes along, he will take his device and use Part 2 to go through and select which functional requirements match his product or her product. And here's an example. So that's security functional requirements. Is there any questions about a security functional requirement before I go on? This is kind of an important thing to understand as we dig into protection profiles later on. So just the same as there is a catalog of functional requirements that exists in the common criteria, there's also a catalog of what we call assurance requirements. And an assurance requirement is an action that the evaluator or developer must perform to generate assurance. So an example of an assurance requirement would be a requirement for testing. So AT, IND, similar, we have a nomenclature to identify each requirement. The developer shall provide the TOE for testing. Good requirement, yep, we should do that. So that's explicitly defined. So that's one assurance requirement. And then we see the match, and that's on the developer, so that's an action for the developer. And then we see a matching action for the evaluator. The evaluator shall test a subset of the thing under evaluation to confirm that the thing under evaluation operates as specified. So here we see this is kind of how the common criteria builds out assurance in terms of discrete requirement statements. So these security assurance requirements, of which there is a catalog in the common criteria, have been and are neatly packaged into some pre-canned, if you like, sets of assurance requirements, and these are referred to as evaluation assurance levels. And at the dawn of time, when the CC was created, these were the set of assurance requirements that the folks at the time thought, hey, this makes sense. And we can see the graph on the right there is, I don't know if you can make sense of that, but essentially across the top there you can see EAL1, EAL2, EAL3, etc., up to EAL7. So you'll see at EAL1, for example, there's a 1 next to ADV-FSP. So that means at EAL1, you don't have to provide any additional design information other than whatever this FSP thing is, which happens to be a functional specification. So the developer has to provide at EAL1 a basic functional specification, some guidance documentation. They have to provide some lifecycle information. They have to provide a security target, and they have to do a little bit of independent testing. And you'll see as you move up the assurance scale, these packages start to get a little more comprehensive. The numbers start to rise, which means the depth and the rigor increases, and the information that's required also increases. So this is kind of the traditional way that EALs come about. They're a pre-packaged set of all of these little individual security assurance requirements packaged into nice little sets of EALs. And so for example, from our example earlier, the developer shall provide the TOE for testing. You can see on our little handy little graph that happens for every EAL. So that's security functional requirements and security assurance requirements. So security functional requirements, historically, these were selected by the vendor to match their product, and selected in a way that was advantageous for an efficient evaluation, let's say. And traditionally, the schemes and the certifiers were kind of like the gatekeepers for the scoping of an evaluation. So if a vendor came to them with a security target that had one SFR in it, they would kind of go, well, maybe you should, you know, have some network connectivity and that kind of thing. So that was the old school way of doing things, was the vendor would pick their own SFRs and then the product would get evaluated. The other increasingly historical way of doing things was the security assurance requirements in the security target was simply referenced by an EIL. So you would specify your security functional requirements, and you would pick an EIL depending on your market demand, typically EIL2, EIL4, and that we all kind of knew what that meant, at least in the industry, perhaps not the consumer. And so this was how a security target works, is that we have an EIL level and we have some SFRs. So we know what we're evaluating, and we know how we're evaluating it. And I won't go into the methodology for evaluation. There's another part to the common criteria which instructs the evaluator how to actually do some of these actions. But I won't get too far into that for the sake of time. So just to make sure you're all kind of with me, I'm going to throw out a pop quiz. Sorry, I don't have any candy. Got a business card up here? No. Who could tell me what the toe is? Anyone? Anyone at all? Yes, we have a gentleman.
Target of evaluation.
Yes, that's right. The target of evaluation, which is? Anyone else? Someone from NIAP, perhaps? I don't know. You guys know? We know all the answers. So yeah, it's the thing we're looking at, right? So exactly. So if we're talking about this guy's head, maybe the toe is the camera, but the consumer buys the head, right? So what is the security target? Can anyone tell me in a few words? Security target. Anyone? Any consultants in the room? Oh, Aaron Connor, he's right.
It's the specification of what the product does.
Exactly. Exactly, and it defines the toe. So that's good. SFR, can anyone tell me? Someone who's not in the CC industry. Any vendors? Can you tell me what an SFR is? I heard it. Who said that? Security? Yes, thanks, Dana. SAR?
Assurance
requirement, that's right. And EAL? All right, excellent. You guys will be consultants in no time. Okay, so we kind of got some common criteria concepts there. So now we can talk about protection profiles, now that we have the little bit of understanding. So a protection profile simply defines the desired target of evaluation, whereas a security target is a vendor's expression of the product. The protection profile is a statement of requirement from a user community. And it's a document as well. And it looks surprisingly similar to a security target. Has all of the same components except for the toe summary specification. So we have an introduction that talks about what the desired target of evaluation will look like, what a product that can conform to this protection profile should do, what are the conformance claims related to the protection profile, which version of the CC, which set of assurance requirements we're looking at, the security problem definition, threat model, all of that stuff, including security functional requirements. So the PP author will go through CC Part 2, maybe create their own security functional requirements that expresses exactly and precisely what that community wants out of a product. And they may leave some of the tailoring of the functional requirements, so where the vendor can actually fill out, I provide, you know, passwords and finger scan for authentication. The PP author can leave that blank and let the vendor just decide, or the PP author might say, you know what, we only want passwords and not finger scanning, or we definitely want multiple authentication, so we'll require two-factor authentication. And so this way, a community can define precisely what they want from a product, and they can put it out there so that vendors can conform. There's also the security assurance requirements, which again we saw can either be a reference to an EIL or can be some defined package that the PP author decided to go with. So we might have a custom assurance package that doesn't include an EIL. It might just be something that Scheme came up with, or user community. So, to revisit some of our previous pictures, we have the consumer here stating, I want this kind of toe, and produces the widget protection profile. And then the vendor comes along and says, hey, I can do that. So they produce the security target, the best widget security target. And then everyone's happy, right? So that's the idea, that's the general model. So a security target conforms with protection profile. Tracking, everyone following with me here? This is good? I see a few nods, so that's good. That's good. So, remember that historically security functional requirements were chosen by the vendor. Well now, with a protection profile, the vendor ensures that their product can implement the required security functions. So it's consumer driven rather than vendor driven. And the security assurance requirements, historically they were just an EIL claim. More increasingly we're seeing, in a lot of NIAP PPs you won't see an EIL. You'll just see a list of separate assurance requirements. And that's completely within the purview of the common criteria, and it's just a custom package of assurance requirements. So, what else can we talk about with regards to protection profiles? The newer types of protection profiles, for example, NIAP protection profiles were the first to do this, and collaborative protection profiles that we'll talk about in a little bit also do this. They specify what are called assurance activities. Now, these are in addition to security assurance requirements, and they're typically specific for each security function or functional requirement. So an assurance activity provides very detailed prescriptive actions that the evaluator must perform in order to, for example, test a security function. So an assurance activity for, here we have an example, for audit storage, FAU STG.4.1, don't worry about all that stuff. The thing under evaluation shall overwrite the oldest stored audit records if the audit trail is full. Okay, so that's a security functional requirement, very discrete piece of functionality that the TOE has to provide. And here's an assurance activity that maps to that. The evaluator shall examine the TOE summary specification, that little bit at the end of the security target that actually tells you what the product does and how it meets all the SFRs. The evaluator shall examine that to ensure that it describes the size limits on the audit records, the detection of a full audit trail, the actions taken by the TOE when the audit trail is full, and the evaluator shall ensure that the actions result in the deletion and the override and the oldest stored record. So for every SFR in your protection profile and subsequently security target, there'll be a corresponding assurance activity that is very, very detailed and prescriptive. And if we looked at this protection profile that I extracted this one from, there's probably underneath this assurance activity about looking at the TOE summary specification, there's probably a number of tests. Test one, the evaluator shall. Test two, the evaluator. So it's become a very prescriptive exercise with protection profiles that include assurance activities. This can be a good thing because you know exactly what the lab is going to do by looking at the assurance activities. So, to recap a little bit there. Yeah, please step up to the microphone.
Just to confirm my understanding, so protection profiles are pertain to different classes, right? Different maybe
types of products,
devices, or whatever.
Yep.
So, what if the vendor has something that does not really belong to any of them?
That's a great question. Very good question to ask. So there's a number of ways to handle that. So, and there's a number of scenarios. One scenario is there's no protection profile that matches your product. In that scenario, it's kind of different for each common criteria scheme around the world has their own policies around how common criteria works for them. So some schemes will allow you to undergo evaluation with a security target and no protection profile. So you can take your security target, write it up, have an EAL claim, so for example EAL2, and you could go to a scheme that accepts those types of evaluations and undergo evaluation there. So that's one scenario. And if that's acceptable for your consumers, then that's a valid path to take. Another option is to comply with a protection profile that most closely aligns with your product. Another option is to comply with multiple protection profiles, and we'll get into a little bit about what are called, now they're called modular protection profiles, but historically or most recently they were called extended packages, so you could have a base protection profile with an extended package. With the newer protection, it used to be that you could claim conformance to a protection profile and then add some additional stuff on. So we do, yeah, everything that the protection profile does, but we also do this other stuff, and you could include that in your security target. Under the new regime of doing things, the conformance claims within a protection profile are called strict, and they're limited to exactly what is in the protection profile and no more. At least that's the case in North America. I'd have to double check if the CC actually now precludes that. So there's some options there for you. Thanks for that question, that's a really good one. So the vendor produces the security target and the consumer group produces the protection profile. And with collaborative protection profiles, we'll see that consumer group is actually made up, typically, more of vendors, labs, and schemes, and consultants, and not so much of the consumer, unfortunately. But in reality, the vendor is probably closest to the consumer, and one would hope that consumer requirements drive the vendor innovation. There is now a defined process whereby a technical community or an international technical community can be formed of various stakeholders to develop a protection profile. And these protection profiles are known as collaborative protection profiles. To be an official collaborative protection profile goes through the formal CC, Common Criteria Development Board kind of process, there is a process to follow. You need to have two schemes on board, and then your CPP can be kind of endorsed or not endorsed by multiple nations. I'm not going to go too far into that. Feel free to track me down if you want to find out a little bit more about that after the talk. But enough to say that there's a formal process. But you can be a technical community without that to just as a starting point. So a technical community, typically the Common Criteria User Forum is the place we have workshops, biannual workshops, and the technical communities often gather at those meetings. They get together and actually produce protection profiles. And a CPP will include what's the protection profile that I just described, but there'll also be a set of supporting documentation that is produced, which contains the assurance activities that I talked about, the very detailed steps, and also some guidance for vendors who are complying. So there's these two formal outputs produced, and if you're a recognized ITC, then those outputs have to be approved then by the Common Criteria Development Board, and then they'll be endorsed. Each nation still retains the right to endorse or not endorse a CPP, and they'll post their endorsement statements on the Common Criteria portal. So there's a few more slides. We can get into some questions around that shortly. So, I mentioned previously protection profile modules or extended packages. So this is just hot off the presses. This is a new version of the Common Criteria, CC version 3.1, release 5. And the main thing that it did was add a concept of PP modules. And in that concept, if you're familiar with NIAP protection profiles, NIAP introduced the concept of a base protection profile and an extended package. The new version of the CC basically codifies that innovation, and there's a base PP, and then there's a PP module. So extended package equals PP module, if you like. So that's that just allows, so for example, for network device, which is the CPP that is published right now, so you might have a network device and then which covers things like management, audit, authentication, secure protocols, just things that you would expect of a well-behaved network device. And then the extended package or the PP module might address more specific functionality like VPN gateway, traffic filter firewall, those sorts of things, so that then you can layer on these additional bits of functionality. So the PP module is the new thing. So watch this space. So how do you get involved in all of this stuff? The simple answer is to join a technical community. So I've got some links up there, CC User Forum. NIAP have a list of technical communities that they run. Common Criteria Portal has the list of official collaborative or international technical communities. And there's also a space on GitHub where some of the technical communities post their stuff. So if you're wanting to shape the requirements or just be involved in terms of understanding where the requirements are going, then it's a great idea to join a technical community. And if there is not a technical community that fits your product, then it may be an idea to start one. And if you start to get involved in if you start to check out some of these links, you'll, especially CC User Forum, is a good place. You can just post questions, you can start to get involved, and you'll find out how to get things going and how to get involved. So I definitely encourage that involvement to get ahead of the curve. So what I want to do now is, with my last 7 minutes, I think I have, is talk just briefly about how you might go about complying with a protection profile. Just the overall process, not going to go too in-depth, and then we'll take some questions. So this is called a snake diagram. Anyway, snake diagram of the PP compliance process. So the first thing you want to do is pick one. Find out which protection profiles meet your requirements. And the largest in North America, NIAP have the largest list of protection profiles and probably the definitive list. So I recommend you would, if you're wondering what protection profiles are available to you, and if North America is a desirable market for you, then if you go to the NIAP website, you can find their list of protection profiles. So select a profile. The next thing to do is, now that you have to meet a set of functional requirements, and not only those, but also be able to achieve or support the assurance activities and the tests that the evaluator is going to perform, you need to do a gap analysis, because what we're finding is that at first go round, there's always gaps. So you're going to need to do a gap analysis, and ideally, that gap analysis will involve some form of testing. It used to be, and I mean, I've been a consultant for a long time, the way I would use to run a gap analysis would be, I would set a time for a workshop with the vendor, maybe 2-day workshop, and I'd be like, you need to have your product guru who knows everything about the product in the room, or the set of people. And I would go there and I would sit down and we'd put the PP up there on the screen and step through exactly each requirement. And I'd be like, do you guys do this? And you know, like go through the whole thing. And you know, it kind of works. It kind of gets there, but that is kind of, it's a drain on your dev resources, on your gurus, and B, it's prone to human error. Like, a lot of times, you know, I would be like, hey, do you guys audit this little special little TLS thing? Yeah, we audit everything. And then, you know, you get down the road, and sure enough, there's no audit record for that thing. And then that means, and that's at the end of the evaluation process, right? When you're going through all your evaluation, they've looked at all the documentation, and then finally the test lab gets to testing, and you've got like 2 months left on your timeline for your evaluation, and then it's like, oh, actually, you got to go and cut code and respin. You don't want to have to do that right at the end. You want to do that right at the start. So if you can test right at that start phase, then that's the best thing. So after that gap analysis, there's going to be a code spin, and maybe that's going to go around a couple times. Then when you're ready, that's when you get into the evaluation. So when you're confident that you meet all of the requirements, you get into the evaluation. And by the way, when you're doing that gap analysis phase, that's when you should be producing your security target document, starting to produce some of those artifacts that are going to go into the evaluation phase with your lab. And then there's a lab cycle where the lab will review your inputs and they'll provide comments to you, and you kind of go around a circle a little bit until the lab's happy, and then the lab will submit to the scheme. And then the same thing will kind of happen. There'll be this scheme has comments. Scheme always has comments. And that's a good thing. That's part of the process. And there'll be a circle, and you'll iterate until you get your certificate at the end. So we've got a few minutes left. What I want to do just briefly what I might do is just take questions, and I might ask a colleague of mine, Greg McClone, just to come up, just in case some of the questions pertain to the testing aspect. Greg is one of our lightship gurus. He's our brain behind the operation.
I left my shirt at home.
Yeah. If you have any questions about that testing phase in the gap analysis, Greg has been the brains behind a product that actually automates a lot of that testing with regards to right now the network device collaborative protection profile. But I'll open it for questions, and if there's no questions, I'll get Greg to talk a little bit about that testing phase. But if there are any questions, please. We have one.
Yeah, how is something like ISO 19790 the same or different than common criteria and protection profiles?
So 19790 is
ISO FIPS.
Yeah. Right, okay. So in that respect, one is crypto and one is common criteria. So the linkage between
they have nothing to do with
Windows? No, no. So they do. So CPPs, because they're international, CPPs will refer to ISO standards, whereas NIAP protection profiles historically referred to US standards. So if you're complying with a NIAP protection profile, it would have referenced the FIPS standard. For the crypto components, so essentially NIAP says for crypto, for the algorithms, we accept FIPS 140. And so for collaborative protection profiles, I'm not sure if any, do they actually reference ISOs?
So some of the ISOs are referenced for algorithms, I believe, but not, in many cases, the NIST, sorry, the NIST, many of the NIST requirements or documents are still referred in those crypto requirements. So there's a lot of overlap, and I think from an international perspective, it's about trying to find something that fits or is available, and if nothing is available or whatnot, then the NIST standards have been injected in there. Your scheme would probably find something and consider whether you have a close equivalent that's nationally recognized that could replace it, but that would be a scheme specific decision.
Yeah, so they are related, and most likely the relation would be for the crypto pieces, the protection profile may reference an ISO. But it's not like you can do one and not do the other. You would still have to do both processes. But you get points for doing one, unless you go through a scheme that doesn't endorse that protection profile. We could talk later too if we need to clarify further.
I have a practical question. Let's assume this scenario when security target have to claim conformance with two different profiles, protection profiles, which overlap each other. And this situation may happen that the same SFR are stated somehow different in both of them. Is it a rule how to deal with this situation which could be acceptable by certification body?
Yeah, that's a good question. So. With regards to complying with multiple protection profiles, typically there would be, they would typically be related to each other and written in such a way that you would either identify the SFR, which would be a superset, which would be the more stringent SFR is what you can,
yeah.
And then you would include an application note to say this is what we did. But yeah, typically if you're complying with multiple protection profiles, the only one in North America would be either you're using an extended package which extends the network device protection profile, or you're doing something like an ESM, an enterprise security management protection profile, which has multiple PPs that you have to kind of comply with in one security target. It is tricky, but
single security target document.
Yeah, the way you address it is with application notes by describing exactly we did this. I'm working with the scheme as well.
Okay. And another question probably to Greg. It's about gap analysis and testing.
Yeah.
Like the main document, the assurance requirements are stated and evaluator shall do something. Mm-hmm. It's nothing about vendor. And what happens if the product doesn't provide some interface for evaluator to do what is prescribed by a supporting document? Is it somehow should be considered for analysis?
I guess it would depend on the protection profile. Certainly, so in the if we're talking maybe about the network devices protection profile as an example,
mandatory. Not mandatory network device.
No, not necessarily. But the idea, I guess, is that there's a certain level, and it's a base level of functionality that has to be provided, like Lachlan was saying, to be basically a well-behaved network device. The functional scope, at least for network devices, is basically on secure manageability, audit, authentication, things like that. So if you are if you don't comply with those pieces, it might be a case where either your product doesn't necessarily fit into that protection profile.
The question is a little bit different. There is a specific activity and the supported document,
yep,
which needs some interface to execute this activity, which is not part of the product.
Okay, so you don't offer a way to do that test, is what you're saying?
Exactly.
So you would have to, at least in the protection profiles, you would have to comply with them.
So you have to implement it.
You would have to implement something.
Okay.
Or there may be a circumstance where it's a discussion with the scheme.
Yeah, exactly.
If there's an alternative assurance activity that provides the same level of assurance that the scheme agrees to, then there's perhaps a chance that you could use an alternative method that provides the same level of assurance. However, that would have to be agreed to by the scheme.
Yes, it depends a lot on the scheme. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
How are we going for time there? We're way over. All right, we're 5 minutes over, so thank you very much. Please feel free to